human interaction. She herself had more theories than ever there were real things in the world to animate them all. And she was drawn to people whose theories of consociation were excessive. Me, for instance. But her work brought her in contact with people whose theories were far more exciting, dangerous, and stupid than mine. Among these was a rented house full of student-age Trotskyites who called themselves the Rosa Luxemburg Collective. Corey rather liked these self-professed terrorists, or at least she was intrigued by them, and through her they became more or less friends of ours. The community underground press had voiced its share of radical cant. We were all, even Barry, in favor of a revolution. In fact, we had talked ourselves into a political position far to the left of anything that made sense. Bob, however, drew the line at killing anyone. He would gladly support, he said, a war of liberation, but not if anyone was going to get hurt. Gandhi never hurt anybody, he said. I was more radical than that. I suspected that even Gandhi had had a few rifles tucked away. I was perfectly willing, I said, to kill for the revolution, but only if it were very important. After all, that was why I wanted to kill people, because they were killing people in Vietnam and elsewhere, and that was wrong. So it would have to be very important before I would kill someone, too. And I believe I secretly trusted that if it ever got as important as that, I would be able to talk myself into thinking it wasn't so important after all. The people in the Rosa Luxemburg Collective, however, had talked to themselves a bit more than Bob and I had, and had talked themselves right out of any such bourgeois scruples, so that, they said, they stood ready to kill for the revolution whether it was important or not. In fact, they stood so ready to kill for the revolution that they were in something of a quandary as to why they hadn't done so, especially the collective's leader, or chairman, a fellow named Red Lenny, whose real name was Leonard Finnerman, and who was as extreme and committed a revolutionary as the minor hypocrisies and mild indignities of upper-middle-class suburban life had ever produced. Lenny was determined to kill a cop, or to injure one, or, at any rate, to do something bad to someone bad who held some sort of authority somewhere in this vast, bad republic of ours. And cops were more widely available than, say, generals, and were easily identifiable by their uniforms, which congressmen, for instance, were not, and were much less protected than the president or someone like that. So, a cop it was. Thus, I think, went the reasoning of Lenny and his compatriots, though doubtless not even so clearly as that. I mean, they didn't really set out to assassinate a policeman. They were just burning with embarrassment at having called for so much mayhem without having committed any. And thereby, they set in motion a little drama into which my friends and I would be dragged. What got us in trouble was a newsreel. The four of us weren't satisfied with mismanaging a newspaper. We wanted something else to mismanage, too. It was Bob who had the idea. We would film and record all manner of events that involved people like ourselves, or at least people with haircuts like ours, and then every month we would show this film at, well, we'd find some place to show it. People would doubtless pay a buck or so to see themselves as they saw themselves. Barry was enthusiastic. He wanted to expand, he said, his arena of professional failure, and said he thought he'd meet more girls going broke in movies. So he volunteered to buy a Super 8 sound camera. Then we set about making a sort of ill-defined documentary of everything that was happening, or more often attempting to be made to happen in what was then called the counterculture. Bob was director, Barry was cameraman, I forget what I was supposed to be, and Corey was anchorwoman. We filmed an interview with a coming, now gone, rock group. I remember the most interesting thing about them was their preposterous name, and I don't remember that anymore. We filmed the opening of a free university, which was something of a fizzle, since among the things this university was free of were campus, curriculum, faculty, and student body. We tried to film a natural childbirth, but Bob and Barry got sick to their stomachs. We filmed an urban farm where 200 cubic feet of topsoil had been dumped on a tenement roof. Unfortunately, part of the roof collapsed, and only the radishes sprouted on the rest of it. Bob pronounced the radish bread delicious, and Corey told our viewers that the radish tea was nice. And we had our weather report given by an authentic member of the Weathermen faction of SDS, disguised with a plastic waste paper basket over his head. We had to stick the microphone up inside the waste paper basket, and the audio results were not very satisfactory. I do remember hearing the phrase, "There's a shitstorm coming." All in all, it was a pretty fair piece of work, we thought, but it lacked action. There was a riot due in about a week, a 4th of July demonstration against the war and everything else, in front of City Hall. I suggested we wait until then, when no doubt we would get plenty of action footage. 2 months before, on the anniversary of the Cambodia incursion, someone had caught a tear gas grenade in a fielder's mitt and tossed it back into the middle of the mounted police, causing a police horse stampede through the middle of the outdoor vegetable market and resulting in everything anyone could want cinematically. We were hoping for something at least as good on July 4, what with the veterans group marching and all. And it did turn out to be a good riot. 1,000 of us gathered in the big square in front of the new City Hall building, which was cordoned off by rows of sweating, irritated police who had been restrained by decree of the Liberal mayor from use of unnecessary force. And necessary force, I'm afraid, was not going to carry the day. We milled around, chanting and screaming, and working ourselves into a lather, and then some inspired young strategist among us urged a feint at the veterans parade 2 blocks away. There was no real leader to the crowd. More correctly, there were 1,000 would-be Franz Fanons, but we knew a good idea when we heard one, or maybe we didn't and just itched for a wild surge in some direction. So we surged for the parade, and the cordon of police went running, half-suffocated in their riot helmets, with all their police equipment flopping on their bodies, trying to head us off and keep us from being beaten bloody by VFW band leaders and enraged packs of American Legionnaires. Our assault drew up about 50 yards from the parade. This was the tactic, of course, except, of course, it wasn't. It was the orderly rows of angry veterans that gave us pause, traversing our front line with their eyes turned toward us, with the intent of doing to us just what our fathers must have often considered doing. And the only thing that kept them from doing it immediately was the self-imposed dignity of their parade. With both antagonists hesitating, the police were able to interpose themselves. This left the City Hall undefended, and it had been thoughtlessly constructed with an all-glass facade. Paving bricks, pieces of police barriers, and small items of landscaping went through the windows. There was that incomparably wonderful sound of much glass breaking, and then there was a rapturous wave of vandalism. Everything destructible was destroyed. Everything that could be smeared with paint was. Members of the Rosa Luxemburg Collective were notably vigorous, but even those of us with less penchant for wreckage were having a good time. Corey and I ruined a picture of Vice President Agnew and unraveled a fire hose. Bob stayed outside. He really didn't like violence, and there was something of the poor childhood's good sense in him that did not want to see anything nice destroyed, particularly our movie camera. So he and Barry stayed out in the back fringe of the mob, standing on a park bench with Barry filming the panoramic sweep of trampling fist wavers and Bob shouting against the war. We later found out that Red Lenny was also on the outskirts of the demonstration, not 20 yards from Barry and Bob. There were a few police on this side of the City Hall Plaza. The only one visible was standing in an intersection with his back to everything, calmly directing cars and trucks away from the ruckus. He wasn't wearing a helmet or carrying a riot stick. He was just a traffic cop. Lenny sneaked up unseen behind this man and cracked him over the head with a length of 2x4. When we got home that night and had showered off the tear gas residue, the traffic cop was already on the evening news. He was unconscious and not expected to live. We also heard from sources of our own that Red Lenny was openly bragging about having done this, or he was until he got arrested for it the next day. Barry said he thought what Lenny had done was chicken shit, and Bob was outraged. He said that this was just the kind of thing that gave violent revolutions a bad name. He sat down and typed out a passionate editorial calling upon the people to mete out revolutionary justice to the assailant. You know who we mean. I think Bob's idea of revolutionary justice was that Lenny would get a real talking to, probably from Bob, and would be converted to a philosophy of passive resistance and would fast for a while to get his head together about things. Even so, Bob and I had a bitter argument about the editorial. I said that no matter how much we might personally disapprove of the specific guerrilla action that Lenny undertook, we must still maintain revolutionary solidarity with the Rosa Luxemburg Collective, and that whatever differences we had with Lenny could be worked out during self-criticism, which was a word we used to use to mean a bitter argument. Actually, I agreed with Barry, but chicken shit didn't have a ring of political correctness. Corey was the closest to Lenny and the other members of his group. She didn't like what he did either, but she didn't know what to think about it, the less so after her dad took the case. Mr. Harrison was sure he could get Lenny acquitted. The prosecution wasn't thought to have any eyewitnesses, and a number of people stood ready to swear that Lenny had been urinating on the mayor's desk at the time of the attack. Then, the day after the arrest, the traffic policeman regained consciousness and was pronounced not to be dying after all. Bob gave in and said that as long as the cop was going to be okay, the editorial didn't need printing, and the case slipped our minds. We went back to work on the newsreel. The demonstration movies returned from the developer, and the four of us pulled the blinds and watched them. They were not spectacular examples of filmmaking. Bob and Barry had been too far away, and when they weren't, people had been bumping them and getting placards and Viet Cong flags in front of the lens, causing a series of surreal camera jiggles and color swirls punctuated by long shots of frenetic denim wearers dashing in one direction and darker blue policemen chasing them back the other way. It was like a pair of thousand-man soccer teams viewed from the cheap seats. We were about halfway through the last of the three reels and talking about how, after all, maybe we could use more of the film we already had on the fellow who had been the town's first and last nude panhandler when something caught Bob's eye. He rewound the movie and ran it again until we came to one of the broad crowd vacillations where Barry had been following a flight of young radicals across the plaza. But as Barry panned along the hippie retreat, he panned too far and swung the lens all the way past the crowd's rear guard. And there, for a few seconds, was the back of a traffic cop, standing out of the path of the riot, obviously directing traffic. And into this frame scurried the perfectly clear form of Red Lenny, 2x4 in hand. Lenny smacked the cop on the head, and before the man could fall, the camera had swung back to the frenzied demonstration. "What was that?" said Barry. "What was that? I never saw that in my life." And he hadn't. The crowd was being gassed, and Barry and Bob were blinking and crying on their park bench, which is how Barry had happened to pan past the running protesters. But it was there on film, Lenny braining the traffic cop. Now here is a part of the story that I don't understand. We did not destroy that piece of film, not even the little section that could be counted as evidence, and that was the only rational thing to do. Instead, we put it in the safe. We had an old safe in the office. Only Corey, Barry, Bob, and I knew the combination. I don't know why we had the safe. There wasn't anything else in it. Even the narcotics cops, when they raided our office, didn't bother to look inside. But we put that reel of film in the safe, and I believe the reason that we did so was in order to have something secret and important to put in there. A momentary thrill could have been had by burning the film in an ashtray and burying the ashes in the yard or something, but a much bigger and more tingly kind of thrill was provided by having it and keeping it and repeatedly swearing each other to secrecy. It gave us something to whisper importantly about for a month. We finished the newsreel, without any demonstration footage, and it was shown somewhere and not actually greeted with hoots, and we started on another, which I can't remember if we ever finished. Then there was the paper to put out, which became all the harder when Corey went back to school at the end of August, and life proceeded with its ordinary proliferation of small concerns and long mescaline interludes. Summer became fall, as it usually does, and the Red Lenny case slipped our minds again. I was spending as much time as I could with Corey. I'd hitchhike out to her family's house in the suburbs in the afternoon, about the time school let out, and we'd sit outside on the lawn and talk or shoot baskets on the driveway apron, When we were alone, sometimes, we'd make love in Corey's bedroom, which was at the southwest corner of the house, and brightly lit at that time of day. I remember lying there one afternoon with my head by her side, and looking at the sunlight on the fine line of down that ran up the middle of her little belly, and thinking that I might never be as happy again. And I haven't. Usually we were alone on those afternoons because the Harrisons, at the behest of Mrs. Harrison, had adopted a 7-year-old autistic boy named Kevin, and Mrs. Harrison had to drive into the city each weekday at 4 to pick him up at the special school he attended. Kevin's autism was severe, and he would stand in a room with his arms flapping up and down like a child playing bird, which perhaps he was, but for hours at a time. He could not talk. It was something to watch Mrs. Harrison that fall, as she made the slowest and most patient progress with him. Just as she made the slowest and most patient progress with me. By October, I was appearing at the Harrison household a little cleaner, and my language in their home was now not quite so free and profane. Kevin was beginning to pay some attention when speech, which he evidently understood, was addressed to him. And though he could not talk, he had begun to think and act. He showed, for instance, great facility in taking apart clocks and other mechanical objects and putting them back together again, too. But even then, I confess it, I didn't like Mrs. Harrison. It's hard to forgive someone when you're beginning to agree with her. Corey, too, was kind and understanding with Kevin, almost as patient as her mother. She thought that Kevin performed his unceasing motions because he could not distinguish between sensations. He was estranged from his emotions, she said, and he could not tell the difference between a good feeling, such as a caress, and any old feeling, such as going bzzz through his nose for an hour, any more than he could love or hate. I used to like to watch her with him, and think how we might have a child of our own some day, though one that didn't wave his arms so wildly. One evening that fall, when Mrs. Harrison and Corey and Kevin and I were sitting in the living room, Mr. Harrison came home in a bad mood. We asked him what was wrong, and I believe I can recall what he said with some accuracy. "It's the damn Lenny Finnerman case," he said. "We had something called a pretrial discovery today, where the damn prosecution tells you the goddamn evidence they've got against your damn client. And the goddamn DA has a goddamn film clip of Lenny hitting the officer right over the fucking head. I've seen it." Corey looked at me, and I looked at the floor, and then we both looked at the floor. And I kept looking at the floor, and I said, "I hate to tell you this, but I know where that film came from." So I told Mr. Harrison the story of the newsreel, and lacking any other facts than those I put down here, he and I and his daughter began to conjecture. We conjectured that the police had seen Bob and Barry filming on the day of the demonstration, and that, on a hunch, they had gone to one of the 4 members of the newspaper staff and convinced or coerced that person into giving the film to the district attorney. Corey was out of the question, and so was I, as long as I was in the room. So it must have been either Bob or Barry who had turned informant. Oddly, Mr. Harrison was one more person who never asked why the film wasn't destroyed. And it's my belief now that he was no more immune than the rest of us to the excitation of intrigue. Instead, we discussed how angry Bob had been about the attack, and whether or not this was sufficient motive for him to have given the film to the prosecutor. Possibly, we thought, if the officer had died. But he had not, and was back on duty. And even if he had, Bob was too kindly to turn anybody in to anyone else. To do so, anyway, would have deprived him of the only thing he had, which was the unanimous affection of every hairy, bead-decked creature under 30 in the area. It must have been Barry. Barry had rich parents who, if they found out what he was doing with his allowance, might give him no allowance to do anything. That's a shameful motive to impute to a friend. But Barry was the only one of us open to pressure from the police. It happened that, at that moment, Bob and Barry were together, en route to visit a friend of Bob's in Florida. They'd left that day in Barry's car and weren't expected back for a week. There would be nothing we could do or discover until then. So I stayed overnight in the guest room at the Harrisons and went back to the newspaper office in the morning. But when I arrived, Bob was there at his desk with his face in his hands, crying. It seems that Barry and he had gotten no farther than 100 miles or so the evening before, and that when talking, as they always did, Barry had said he had a confession to make. He said it was something that he'd wanted to confess for a long time, but that he hadn't been able to bring himself to do so, which was so unlike Barry that Bob said it made him start, and that this was the reason he'd wanted to go on the trip to Florida with Bob, because he felt closest to Bob, and he wanted to be alone with just one of us so he could tell the whole of the thing that he wanted to tell, which was that he was a cop, an undercover cop, and he always had been, and that he'd been assigned to infiltrate radical left-wing groups, and he thought he'd do that by becoming a staff member of the Community Underground Press. But then he'd come to love us all, Bob and Corey and me, and he was sorry now, and so on. Bob listened to him for a little while, too shocked, he said, not to, and then he told Barry to stop the car, just to stop the car and let him out. Barry asked him please not to leave, to hear his whole side of the story, but Bob just said to let him out, and Bob got out, and he'd been hitchhiking back all night. Bob couldn't believe it. Barry was his friend. If Barry had told him he was a cop first, Bob said, he still would have been Barry's friend. But to have been his friend and then be a cop... I exploded. Barry was a spy. This time it was very important. We had to kill him. He had to be offed, I believe, I said. Bob began screaming no. Barry was still his friend. We got into a long, loud argument about whether to kill him, and I walked out. After I walked out, I realized a couple of things. I realized I had no place to go. I couldn't go back to the Harrisons. Only Mrs. Harrison would be there. Corey, Barry, and Bob were my only close friends. But I couldn't go back to the newspaper, and the Rosa Luxemburg Collective was out of the question just then. And I realized I couldn't kill Barry either. Not because I could talk myself into thinking it wasn't important. I thought it was. I thought it was the most important thing ever in my life that I kill him. But I didn't have the courage. I maybe had the courage to pull the trigger and see the blood come out of his face and watch him fall down. But I definitely did not have the courage to hide from the police and be caught and be tried and be sent to prison. And then I also realized I didn't have a gun. Our only weapons belonged to Barry, which made perfect sense. So I wandered around feeling despicable and a little stupid and lonely and frightened, and beginning to feel chilly, too. Sometime that afternoon, I came across a girl I knew slightly, Anna, a member of another one of the local radical groups. She was loading things into a borrowed panel truck. She'd just found a new apartment downtown. I helped her move there, and when we were done moving, I moved in, too, with the clothes I had on and about $2. Bob wouldn't speak to Barry. I wouldn't speak to Bob. And Corey, after she found out about Anna, wouldn't speak to me. I got a job working construction, and then I moved to New York. Bob put out a special edition of the Community Underground Press in which he explained that we, unknowingly, had had a member of the police force on our staff since our first day of publication. In an overweening fit of truthfulness, however, he went on to say that he still felt affection for Barry, and that in many ways Barry had been a true friend, while, of course, still being an informer, a spy, and a pig. The Community Underground Press expired shortly thereafter. Red Lenny's case came to trial that winter, and Barry was put on the stand. He was not a rich kid. There was no allowance from home. The money he had was his salary, and his cameras belonged to the police department, the movie camera, too. He did not have his film developed by a friend from prep school who runs a film lab for his dad. That fellow whom we'd met was a police officer also. The police department developed all of Barry's photographs, giving him a set of prints and keeping a set for themselves. They must have had a nice collection of semi-naked hippie girl pictures. Barry explained how, as a plainclothes man, he had been assigned to the surveillance of left-wing political groups, and how he had accomplished this by becoming a staff member on an underground newspaper. To my humiliation, when I later heard of it, he told the court that the staff members of this newspaper were not themselves considered dangerous. We were, he said, noisy but harmless. Basically just high-spirited kids having fun and maybe trying to shock our parents. But being a staff member gave him access to groups who really were dangerous, and the Rosa Luxemburg Collective was certainly one of these. Then Barry began to calmly muff his testimony. He claimed, under direct and then under cross-examination, to have been filming at some location far away from the incident. He said he'd been alone, and there was no one to corroborate the time or place. He confused the dates and said it was hard to remember one demonstration from another. The prosecutor was angry. Barry identified the film as his own, but said he couldn't be at all sure that the young man shown with the 2x4 was Leonard Finnerman, and neither could the jury, for Leonard, Red Lenny, was seated in front of them, shaven, shorn, and suited, with decorous parents at his back, and looking like the honors student that he'd been. So Lenny was acquitted, and Barry was busted back to patrolman, and a couple of months later, Barry quit the force. Bob visited me in New York, and I visited Corey at her house, and the three of us became friends again, though we don't see each other often. One night, Bob met Barry by accident in a bar. He told me he was cool to Barry, but he couldn't refuse to have a beer with the man after the way Barry'd acted at the Finnerman trial. Pretty soon they were drunk and friends again, too. A couple of years went by, and I came to know a New York lawyer who had been an assistant district attorney in 70 and 71 in the city where we had all lived. He'd known Barry as an undercover cop and told me several things. Our offices had been, as I said before, visited by the police on wholly justifiable drug raids. These cases had always been dropped before they came to trial. The same was true on the couple of occasions when one of us was arrested at a demonstration. We had figured it was just good luck, but my lawyer friend said that after each arrest, Barry would rush to the prosecutor's office and plead that his cover would be blown if we ever came to trial. Such was the atmosphere of worry about Black Panthers, SDSers, and who knows what all Barry was supposed to be watching from his vantage point of the newspaper staff, that his requests to have charges dropped were always granted. I told my friend about the weatherman with the waste paper basket over his head, who really was a weatherman and actually wanted by the FBI, though just for a skipped grand jury subpoena, I believe. I said Barry hadn't done much about that guy. My friend said it would have been a surprise if he had, for in 2 years of investigation, Barry had not brought a single subversive into the hands of the law. Nor had he, after the first few months, provided the police with any information that was even vaguely useful. My friend told me something of the contents of our staff's police files. Mine, for instance, noted that my grandfather had been the chairman of the Mattoon, Illinois County Republican Organization and a personal friend of President Taft. It was my great-grandfather, actually. I must have made a joke about it once. Barry did not even mean to incriminate Red Lenny. The police at headquarters had discovered the film of Lenny's assault the same way we had. I never bothered to tell Bob about the things Barry had done to protect us. I figured Bob knew them already, and, knowing Bob, I figured he would prefer to think that he was the only person who believed them. I saw Barry himself a little while ago, and I liked him as well as I ever had. He's a private detective now, and specializes in insurance fraud. He lets the people who really need the money get away with it, though, he said. Mr. Harrison went on to defend a number of other members of the Rosa Luxemburg Collective. One night in 1973, they tried to blow up a suburban branch bank with a homemade kerosene bomb, which destroyed a 3-yard patch of lawn and an ornamental shrub. During the trial, they came to his house one night and asked him to hide a gun for them. It wasn't an illegal gun, just a hunting rifle, and I don't believe they had done anything exciting with it. But they were sure they were about to be raided again, and they didn't want to lose this gun the way they had all the others. Mr. Harrison broke the rifle down, wrapped it in oiled rags, and locked it in a closet. And he took the bolt mechanism and locked that in a file cabinet in his den. Somehow Kevin was able to make his way into the closet and to open the drawer in the file cabinet, too. And he put the rifle back together. And one day, when he was home from school sick and Mrs. Harrison was working in the rose garden in the backyard, he leaned out the kitchen window and shot her through the head. Dynamite. It was a perfect summer, the summer of 1967. Some friends of mine and I had a farm in southern Ohio. There was Michael Visconti, whom we always called Uncle Mike because of a certain avuncular way he had about him, especially when urging people to take more drugs. Uncle Mike is a professor of mathematics at Michigan State these days. And there was Terry Connors, who'd been hanging around the local college campus for years, a few credits short of a degree, running bars and owning pizza joints. He's building condominiums in Hawaii now. And there was Juanita and I. Last I heard, Juanita was living on a yacht in the Caribbean. But this was a long time ago, and we were different people then. We had this farm, and we had a lot of hashish we were selling. We used to get it from a fellow who would drive up from Mexico in a 1948 Pontiac Streamliner Deluxe, which wouldn't seem an inconspicuous way to travel with 30 pounds of drugs in the trunk up through Kentucky with his ponytail flying back to the packet shelf. Even in Ohio in those days, you could get 10 years in prison for simple possession. But like I said, it was a long time ago, and we were different people. And one of the reasons we were so different was all the hashish. It was thick, black-brown slabs of oily, opiated stuff that was supposed to have the official seal of the Royal Hoo-Ha of Nepal on it somewhere, though I never noticed it. And it came wrapped in broiler foil in a cardboard grocery box. I'm sure that the hashish made our farm seem far grander in extent and more lush and exotic of vegetation than ever it really was. And the days rolled by slower and less predictably than they do today. Maybe it was adolescence that did some of that, or maybe memory does it, but certainly the hashish helped. It was particular fun to go hunting or target shooting after we'd smoked some, because we never knew what was going to happen. Terry claimed that his perception of time would grow so acute and slow that he could see the bullet come out of a rifle barrel and travel toward the target. Well, travel toward something anyway. And that he could see shotgun pellets spread, he'd say, like a Roman candle, except not lit. That is, they didn't glow or anything. He was lying, but it was a great farm. It had a big, rambling, dirty farmhouse with dogs and a lamb and a duck and some cats and a tame raccoon running around inside it. And it had a dilapidated barn to make love and take drugs in, with a big empty silo so that you could climb up the side of it and peek over the top of and scare yourself silly with. And there were fields and woods all around, a stream with little rills down to a half-dammed swimming hole, hedgerows along the road and drive, and an old orchard with unpruned limbs making bowers between the rows of trees. There was a herd of sheep grazing in the back pasture. Someone must have come in every now and then and watered them or sheared them or whatever it is you do to sheep. I know we didn't do it. But they were nice to have around, very bucolic from a distance. Up close they smelled and looked dirty. And we had cars and trucks and motorcycles and guns, and we'd sell the hashish or trade it for more guns or more motorcycles, and it was a perfect summer. We'd go rabbit hunting with one of the dogs, chasing rabbits back and forth in front of us while we blasted away. It's important to remember when you're rabbit hunting which is the rabbit and which is the dog. The rabbit is the one that isn't barking. In fact, they don't make any sound at all unless you hit them. But we never hit any, and it was still fun, until we hit one after all. When you do hit them, they make a little tiny squeaking sound, or at least this one did, and it lay there and sniffled and wiggled in agony, all furry and cute and in horrible pain. And, being out of shotgun shells, we had to walk back to the house and get a .45 to blow its head off. Then, since it had died such a hard death, we felt obligated, in a way, to eat it. But rabbits are supposed to carry a disease, rabbit fever, appropriately enough, which is very deadly if you have an open wound or a something else. We couldn't remember which. What you're supposed to do to make sure that they do have it, or that they don't, is to cut them open and look at their liver. You have to make sure it looks normal. What a normal-looking rabbit liver would be, though, none of us could tell. And once we'd cut the rabbit open, we couldn't figure out what part of the stuff in there was the liver part anyway. But we were determined to eat it. It had taken so long to die that it couldn't have been all that sick. So we scooped out the guts and pulled off the skin and put it to soak overnight in a pot full of salt water, which someone had said that someone else said to do. Then we forgot it. I guess it was the hashish. The next time we looked in the pot a week later, we wouldn't have wanted to look in it again. So all we wound up with was a lucky rabbit foot for Juanita. But, after a month, that grew horrible-looking, too, shrinking down so the bone end poked out and turning black and losing a tear. I think one of the dogs got it. Sparrow hunting was much better. Throw out some breadcrumbs and you can get a sparrow to come up so close that when you use a 12-gauge magnum load, full choke, they just vaporize in a puff of feathers. Terry and I found a bunch of old things up in the attic, some Morris chairs and a cast-iron pedal-operated sewing machine, some chamber pots, and an old washstand. And we set them up in the yard, in a sort of little sculpture garden, and then blew them apart by the hour from the upstairs windows using shotgun slugs and 30-30 soft points to get the most impact and splattering of lead and shattering of wood and metal. We'd scatter some beer cans full of water in among the other stuff to explode with hollow point 22s also. It was as pleasant an afternoon as you can imagine, sitting in Juanita's bedroom window with a cold case of Budweiser and the hashish and 20 boxes of ammunition. Then we'd start up a car and chase the sheep around in their pasture and run motorcycles up and down the rows of corn in the front 40. We had rats in the house, and I sat up all one night downstairs, drinking whiskey and smoking hashish in an easy chair in the middle of the kitchen, waiting for them to peek out of their rat holes. Then I'd let loose with a 25 automatic. By dawn, some of those rats poking their heads out of the walls were real, and some of them were not. I don't think I hit any of the real ones, but I was enjoying myself. I was enjoying myself that whole summer. Terry and I had a quarrel about something, and decided we'd settle it with a duel. Among the various cars we had on the farm, there was a 1960 Chevrolet with nearly 150,000 miles on it, and a 1961 Tempest that would barely run. We were up all night fixing the engines, popping the windshields out, and breaking all the knobs and handles and sharp protruding things off the doors and dashboards. Then, we each painted our car with insults about the other and boasts and literary quotes and decorations. Then, in the morning, we put on motorcycle helmets and went down to the end of a mud lane that ran through the back pasture, turned the cars around, placed them side by side, and raced back to the barnyard, slapping sides and slamming into each other. The fenders of the cars, smooth and flexible, would come together with a kind of metallic lubrication, almost a splash, as we tried to shove each other off the path. When we reached the barn, we pulled apart and began circling around as fast as we could turn and slide, sending up showers of old manure and clipping the rickety chicken coops, each trying to position himself to take a run at the other. Terry struck me on the passenger side, a T-bone collision. The window was rolled down, and there was a beautiful geyser of glass up from inside the door. Then I did a bootleg turn midway in a head-on chicken run and punched in his radiator with one fin from my Chevrolet's rear deck lid. But we kept the cars going most of the day, calling a timeout whenever the fenders were bent in so that the tires couldn't turn. Uncle Mike and Juanita would then pry out the wheel wells with crowbars, and we'd go back at it. We'd lunge and dodge and chase our friends out of the way, with Terry spraying steam until he blindsided me, and I was plowed into a chicken coop that fell down around me. From there, the car wouldn't budge, and I could barely get out myself. One of the dogs we had, Juanita's, was a Great Dane with an undocked tail the length of a human arm. It was a happy dog without many nerve endings, and was continually wagging the tail, beating the end of it into a bloody sore against the furniture, kitchen cabinets, and walls. Everywhere it hit, the tail left a big red dot of blood, all the way around the living room walls, at dog-ass height, and up the stairwell and around the rooms upstairs. The dots looked like perforations, and Uncle Mike, with his obsessive calculations, said that if you cut along this dotted line with a chainsaw, you could pull the house apart in a conical helix. I believe he would have tried it if he hadn't been so lazy from the hashish, and if we had a chainsaw. We even had a little mystery and terror on the front lawn when we found the lamb, which was more or less a pet, with its stomach torn open and its insides gone. There were some fat paw tracks around, and Terry, who had more claim to woodcraft since he was the one who had skinned the rabbit, was positive a mountain lion did it. I thought the farmers would laugh at us when Uncle Mike told this to everyone in the local roadhouse the next night. But they were sure it was true. It hadn't ever happened to any of them, with any of their livestock, but you could see that they were envious it hadn't. I've had the story told back to me a number of times since, with the size of the paw prints and the number of dead lambs expanding every time. One fellow volunteered that they might still have these mountain lions in Arkansas, and that this one must have swam the Mississippi and come up through Tennessee and Kentucky and swam the Ohio River, and that's how it got our lamb. There was even talk of a hunt with hound dogs and flashlights, and another lamb staked out for bait, and I don't know what all else. I bothered to look it up, and there hadn't been a mountain lion in Ohio in well over 100 years. I suppose it might have been a bobcat, but we had dogs running loose all over the place, and it was one of these dogs, Juanita's Great Dane, that killed the lamb. He wouldn't go near the carcass, and didn't eat for 2 days. But it would have broken Juanita's heart to say so, and disappointed all the neighbors, too. Besides, this gave us an excuse to go armed outside at night, and gave an excuse for all the men in the neighborhood to do so, too, and to scare their wives out of going into town for bingo. Anyway, life is dull enough in Ohio. Although we didn't think so. There were supposed to be narcotics agents up from Cincinnati after us. We told each other we'd shoot it out with them if they came. We were lying again. But it was fun to think we would, and to talk about how we'd do it when we did. We had a rimfire 30 caliber rifle, and a lever action 30-30 with a 308 Winchester Model 70, and an old hexagonal barreled single shot 22, and a couple of semi-automatic 22 rifles as well, plus a Japanese 8mm military rifle that we didn't have the ammunition for. And we had a 12-gauge Remington pump, a 12-gauge Ithaca single shot, and an old Belgian double barrel made with Damascus twist steel, and a Sears bolt action 20-gauge that jammed all the time. A sawed-off 16-gauge with a pistol grip that Uncle Mike had made, and a high-standard 20-gauge auto-loader. Then we had the 45 service automatic, a snub-nose 38, a 25 Beretta, a 22 Astra Cub, a Luger, a 357 Colt Python, and a pair of old Derringers. But, best of all, we had a case of dynamite. This was Uncle Mike's favorite. He said the application of explosive force was as near to pure mathematics as you could come in the physical world. Although, how he proved this, sticking it down groundhog holes, I have no idea. He used the dynamite under rocks, which would come popping right out of the earth and roll over next to their craters. And he used it under stumps, which would not. He used it up in treetops to produce a sort of instant autumn. He used it in a giant slingshot made of motorcycle inner tube to create a great starburst in the night sky. He used it in the stream, as he said, to fish in the manner of the Filipino, though nothing but muddy water and parts of a few crawdaddies floated to the surface. And he used so much of it out in the pasture that by the end of July the sheep were skinny and looking haunted. He even tried hunting rabbits with it, setting out half a stick with a very long fuse and next to it a bit of lettuce or carrot. Then he'd wait, Zippo in hand, for a very long time. Though it may have been the hashish that made it seem so, and no rabbit would come. Finally, at even the rustling suggestion of a rabbit, he'd set off the fuse. We never found a dead one, but Mike said they may have just disintegrated, like the sparrows. One afternoon in early August, we were sitting out on the front porch of the house, Uncle Mike and Terry and Juanita and I. We'd smoked a very great amount of hashish that day. In fact, we had started before breakfast, and had become so disoriented that we'd been unable to fix any breakfast, or any lunch, and we were barely able to find some potato chips and Fritos and Cokes to make do with, because by dinner time, we were far too insentient to make any of that either. We were just sitting on the porch in a drift, barely able to talk, lost in our own languid fantasies and perceptual distortions, when Uncle Mike suggested a dynamite show. It would be a perfect attraction to view with our heightened senses, he said. Why, he'd wire up 3 whole sticks together and put them out at the far end of the lawn. The effect, he said, would be compared to a whole body orgasm, and there was none of us with energy for, or interest in, disputing him. So Mike went down in the cellar, where he had the dynamite to keep it cool. And he was down there so long that we forgot he was down there at all. But he came back at last and then proceeded to fool and to fiddle with the dynamite sticks. I'm sure that his movements that day were deliberate and slower than the usual slow way that he moved, but the hashish rendered the pace of his activity glacial. It seemed an age, at least, while he lashed the sticks together and decided upon which was most central to the other two, itself a neat mathematical problem. Then, having selected one stick, he pushed the blasting cap into its end, and after that he had to find the brass cap crimpers that were lying around the house somewhere and crimp a fuse into the cap. When he was finally ready with the charge, he set off from the porch on what seemed to us a mission of enormous duration. I could swear we watched him journey out onto the lawn for half an hour before he set the explosives down, carefully set fire to the fuse end, and started running back to the porch. I remember his running. Mike is not a slim man, and is little given to running at all. But he seemed to be moving like a sprinter just then, yet a sprinter seen through a telescopic lens with such foreshortening that he made no progress at all, and no progress in slow motion at that. Finally, he set one foot of a plump, high, pumping leg on the bottom porch step, and just as he did, there was a god-awful eruption of dirt. I was beaten against the side of the house, and Juanita, who was sitting in the porch swing, went backward in it, broke through the railing, and was dumped into the Forsythia. Mike was pitched through the front door screen into the living room, followed by a wave of lawn and soil, and every window on the front of the house was shattered, and half the shingles were blown off the roof. It seemed that Uncle Mike had consumed so much hashish, and that his conception of spatial relationships was so grievously altered that he had planted the dynamite 5 feet from the porch. None of us could hear for a week. But no one was too seriously injured except Terry, who had part of a hash pipe blown up his nose, something they had trouble understanding at the county hospital emergency ward. He recovered, but that was the end of our perfect summer. We had to clear out before the landlord showed up. We sold the rest of that dynamite to the ponytailed fellow who sold us the hashish, and I understand he took it out to a group of California political radicals who used it to explode a Pacific Gas and Electric high-tension transmission tower, an activity that was in vogue just then. I still have the newspaper clipping. No bodies were found at the scene, so I assume those radicals were drinking coffee. Another tale of Uncle Mike. For a while in the spring of 1967, before we moved to the farm, Uncle Mike and Juanita and I shared a house in the nearby college town with a mystic fellow named Steve. Steve had very long fingernails and didn't often bathe. He was in love with the daughter of an Air Force colonel in Dayton. The colonel spoke of Steve only as Dirty Eddie, kept his daughter in a local junior college, and had declared that if Dirty Eddie ever so much as set foot in Dayton, he'd kill him with his own bare hands. Taking the colonel at his word, Steve retired to the pursuit of his own particular brand of mysticism. There were 3 bedrooms in the house, 2 next to each other upstairs and 1 downstairs, which was Juanita's and mine. Steve had found an old stand-up radio which he had carried up to his room and placed in the middle of the floor. The radio was broken, but plugged in, its large orange dial would light up and the speaker emitted a low buzz. Steve claimed that this radio was an Om machine, and that the sound it made was the first syllable of the Buddhist chant, Om Mani Padme Hum. He filled the room with folding chairs that he'd stolen somewhere, arranging them in semicircles around the radio, and spent most of his time in there with all the lights off, taking drugs and staring at the orange dial. Few people ever joined Steve in his Om machine theater, especially not Uncle Mike, who was a devout Catholic, something he showed every Sunday morning in his best suit and every Saturday night in a drunken rage. One such Saturday night, Mike came home more angry than usual and stamped upstairs. He was too drunk to notice that Steve was there. Even Juanita and I didn't realize Steve was home. So low or so familiar was that Om sound. Mike shut himself into his room with the 5 or 6 locks he had mounted on his door, got out his guns, and began firing into the wall between his room and Steve's. He fired 100 rounds or so before we heard the door locks come undone and the sound of Mike's footsteps headed for the bathroom. Then there was a pause and a loud scream from Mike. "I killed him! I killed him! I killed him!" Juanita and I ran upstairs. Mike, still screaming, was kneeling over Steve, who was face down on the floor in a tangle of chair legs. Juanita turned the light on and began feeling Steve's body for blood. trying to get him to talk. She rolled him over, but there didn't seem to be any wounds.
"I'm dead," he said at last.
Mike, meanwhile, had gotten up and wandered into his own room, where I found him screaming, "I killed him! I killed him!" and staring at a wall full of bullet holes. I tried to tell him that Steve was still alive, but he wouldn't listen and stumbled back into Steve's room and started staring at the wall in there. There were no holes in that wall.
"I'm dead," said Steve.
"I killed him! I killed him!"
yelled Mike.
"I'm dead," said Steve.
"I killed him!"
yelled Mike.
"Look," I said, "there aren't even any holes in that wall."
"Of course there aren't," said Juanita. "That's his closet." Which was true. Uncle Mike's closet was between the two rooms, and what he'd done was shoot up all his clothes, which I demonstrated by putting on one of his sports coats and waving my fingers at him through the patch pockets. But it was some time before he left off screaming, "I killed him!" Steve believed it, too. He didn't get up off the floor until the next afternoon.
"I can't get up," he'd say. "I'm dead."
And he remained convinced for quite some time afterward, often refusing to eat or wear warm clothing on the grounds of not being alive. Death also greatly emboldened him, so much so that he went to see his girlfriend at home and danced around her father, singing, "I'm dead, I'm dead, I'm dead, eat shit." The colonel fled the house, and Steve and his girl were married a month later, a spiritual union only, however, since Steve had left the corporeal realm. Everyone concerned eventually came to his and her senses. Steve fully admits to being alive these days. He lives in Miami, where he writes detective novels, and his girlfriend has a very wealthy second husband. Ghosts of Responsibility. One fall, when I was very young and very broke, I returned to college and could find nowhere to live. For a while, I rented a dirty little room, one of a dozen, over a grocery store. There were rats in the walls and one windowless bathroom at the end of the corridor. Also, there was a cancerous old man, a sort of concierge, who lived in one of the rooms. He would not let my girlfriend come upstairs as long as he was awake, and he was always awake. But I couldn't afford anything else. Then, one evening in a bar, a young man named Gary Ballow told me about a place where he used to live. It might still be for rent, he said, if I'd want it. Ballow did not, at the time, seem like a young man to me. He was about 28, and he was a writer. That is, he wrote every day. But one thing he wrote didn't often fit with any other thing he wrote. And his sentences, though splendid to hear, did not parse. He had graduated half a dozen years before, but never left the little southern Ohio college town. He drank a great deal. Until a couple of months before, Ballow had lived in a carriage house behind a deteriorating mansion on the edge of town. He told me to go see the ancient and peculiar Kentucky woman, Miss Beauregard, who owned the property. But I mustn't mention his name. He'd left owing half a year's rent, and she'd sworn to shoot him. The carriage house was comfortable, he said, and cheap. And aside from Miss Beauregard, it had only one drawback. It was haunted. It was very haunted. And Ballow, who, as I said, drank a great deal, insisted on telling me the whole story of its haunting. He talked for 2 hours. The carriage house had been converted to an apartment, a cottage, really, in the late 1950s, and immediately began to accumulate ghosts. They were, said Ballow, the ghosts of responsibility. Each of these shades, he claimed, was a spectral representation of some duty not undertaken, some trust not executed, some human burden someone had failed to heft. And he said much more on the subject in a manner largely poetic. I remember none of it. But I do recall the stories of the four dead people who'd occupied the carriage house and who, he assured me, continued to reside in my future home. The first was the first resident, a woman graduate student. I might hear her story from some professor sometime, Ballow said. If I did, I'd hear she died from some sudden biological lapse, headlong leukemia, or galloping embolism, or the like. This wasn't the case. He'd known her. She had failed to complete her dissertation on some aspect of phonic ratiocination in preschoolers. A completed thesis was necessary to her graduation with a doctoral degree. The graduation had been planned, parents, aunts, and cousins invited, presents selected, a dinner scheduled for catering. She came from a large Jewish family. They were poor, and very proud of their bloodline's first Ph.D. So, she committed suicide with 100 Milltown pills. The second and third ghosts were the result of a party in the spring of 1962. A friend of Ballow's, Woody Upton, was living in the carriage house then. Woody had been dating a local girl, a farm girl of no great intelligence, but with a large, handsome body. Perhaps dating isn't the right word. He fucked her sometimes. She was in love with him. He was not in love with her. She got pregnant. He refused to marry her. And she kept coming to see him, though he told her to stay away. By the time of the party, she was nearly due. As pregnant a woman, said Ballow, as he had ever seen. It was a drunken party with loud music, and everyone danced the alligator, which was a dance where you lay down in the beer on the floor and slithered on your stomach and then flopped on top of someone else who wiggled on her back and so on. The farm girl did it too, though no one jumped on her. She was wiggling like everybody else and hollering like they were also. Then she screamed and pulled up her skirt and took off her underwear, screaming all the while and breathing fast, said Ballow. No one knew what to do. They all stood up fascinated and still. A couple minutes later, she delivered bloody, stillborn twins on the floor, and a minute after that the electricity went out. Then everyone at the party began to scream. There was a terrifying commotion, a sound of moving feet and bodies, but when the lights came on, everyone seemed to be just where they had been before, except the babies. The dead babies were gone. The girl looked everywhere for them. Everyone looked for them. The farm girl kept screaming, but the bodies were gone. I cannot provide the details, much as I would like to. Did the girl leap up fully vigorous from her accouchement and hunt behind the furniture? Or did she lie there prostrate and search the room with her eyes? What about the afterbirth? But Ballow was running downwind with his narrative and could not be made to reach or beat for interruptions. He said only that the babies joined the graduate student thereafter in the house. The fourth ghost was a homosexual high school teacher named Rory. He died in 1963. At that time, another friend of Ballow's, Bob Werhauser, was living in the carriage house with his wife and their newborn child. Rory and the Werhausers had been friends for some years. One night, when the baby was not a week old and his wife was just home from the hospital, Bob went off alone to a party. Ballow claimed to have been at this party also, as was Rory. Sometime after midnight, Rory began to pinch and fondle women guests. This was taken to be a great joke. And sometime after that, Rory said to Werhauser, "You know what I'd really like to do? I'd like to fuck your wife." "No, you wouldn't," said Bob. "You're queer. Besides, she just had a baby. She's big as a ditch." But Rory insisted and disappeared from the party. A little later, Werhauser got a phone call from his wife saying, "Rory's over here at the carriage house. He says he's going to rape me and he's trying to break the door down." "That's insane," said Bob. "He's a homosexual." She called back in 5 minutes with the same message and said she was very frightened. Bob told her she was nuts. She called again and once more after that. Finally, Werhauser told everyone to just let the phone ring. His wife was having delusions. Rory succeeded in breaking the door down. Or actually, it seems, he didn't break it, because when Werhauser came home at 4 in the morning, it was bolted from the inside and no one would answer. Rory and Werhauser's wife stayed in there for 2 weeks. Again, I don't know the details. The Werhauser family reunion must have been interesting. But Ballow was too puffed up with philosophical speculation about Rory's sudden heterosexuality to give me the particulars. Anyway, Bob and his wife did get back together. And Rory went home, which was where he was found about a month later with the oven on and the pilot light out. An attractive boy, one of Rory's students, had stopped by for what Ballow said was some special tutoring. When no one came to the door, the boy tried the latch and found Rory passed out on the bed. It was several weeks before Mrs. Werhauser convinced the doctors to let her visit. She was shown to the hospital room and was there confronted by Rory covered in an oxygen tent, attached to an artificial kidney, with a glucose bottle running into his arm and feeding tubes up his nose. She shrieked and ran across the room, gathering Rory to her chest, oxygen tent and all. The tubes and needles were pulled from his body, the dialysis machine was overturned, and Rory died an hour later. I don't know what exact response